Hello and welcome to Playback. Fiona Kelly here, standing in for Marion Richardson.
Today, here in Royal Windsor, the many flags on the High Street are being flown to celebrate the arrival of Mr. Michael Higgins, the President of the Republic of Ireland.
Hooray!
That's a man you'll no doubt have heard a few times on air this week. He's the official town crier for Windsor, Chris Brown, and he very much embodied all the pomp and pageantry attached to the official state visit of our President Michael D. Higgins to Britain this week. On the first day of the visit, both Morning Ireland and the Today Show broadcast live from Windsor Castle. And later in the day, we heard some of the edited highlights of that day's coverage on Drive Time.
The Queen is now alighting from her car, wearing it. Well, perhaps you'd like to take up on that one on the pictures, Olivia or Mary. The Queen is in light blue.
It's the Holy Mary blue, isn't it, Mary? Very smart indeed.
The Queen has just got out now. She's going up onto the Royal Days opposite. And the band of the Household Cavalry, you can probably hear them in the background. Now, the President is due to arrive in just a couple of minutes.
In fact, his car has just come into shot, and he is arriving at Datchet at the dais, where he'll get the royal welcome from Queen Elizabeth at the start, the official start of this first state visit by the President of Ireland to Great Britain.
It's an extraordinary moment, and Michael D managing the ceremony of all this, as one would expect. He was always a man who understood the need sometimes for pomp.
Again, some of the ceremonial welcome is unfolding before us with that.
Wonderful to hear the Irish anthem played.
Absolutely.
Solemnly.
Yes, they're getting ready to leave now in what's called a carriage procession with the Sovereign's escort. Now the British anthem.
We look at, just look at this, from the shining carriages to the glistening coats of the horses, their oiled hooves, the music, the cavalry, and we're just coming now to the carriages.
There is President Higgins waving to people on his left, the Queen closer to us, a very warm, enthusiastic reception.
And I hope President Higgins is feeling okay, because it can be quite a sort of seasick-making feeling, actually, being in one of these carriages. They rock and roll around a bit. But he will have had a snug little rug placed over his knees if he wanted it, and sometimes a sneaky hot water bottle in there as well.
Mr. President, you could not be more welcome here than you are. We would be honoured if you would now address us.
Long may our two peoples and our parliament walk together in peace, prosperity, and ever closer friendship between Ireland and Britain. Mr. Speaker, members, thank you again for your kind welcome. Cura míle maith glair is bear banner.
And some of the commentators who you'll have heard in that Drive Time compilation there, alongside RTÉ's Sean O'Rourke, Fergal Keane and Valerie Cox, were Olivia O'Leary, Mary Kenny and Jenny Bond. As well as being an event which involved lots of pomp and ceremony, Ireland's first official state visit to the United Kingdom was also, of course, all about politics. One of the most noteworthy attendees at the state banquet at Windsor Castle was Martin McGuinness, Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland. He spoke to Richard Crowley in advance of that event on last Sunday's This Week.
Are you sure this is a good idea?
Well, I think this is a very important event that's taking place next week. We have taken a decision that I will be attending events as part of a state visit of the president of my country to Britain. And I will be doing so as a representative of all of the people of the North, and also in the context of conflict resolution and building reconciliation among the people of Ireland, and also between the people of Ireland and the people of Britain. But I'm conscious that this decision is very significant and does involve political and symbolic challenges for Irish Republicans. But my presence alongside Peter Robinson and, of course, the President brings an all-Ireland dimension to what is an historic event, and which is, as we all know, taken 93 years to happen.
Who invited you, by the way? Was it the Queen or the President?
Well, I take it as a joint invitation. And it obviously follows on from the visit of Queen Elizabeth to the South a number of years ago. And my meeting with her not so long ago in Belfast. And the handshake, which was widely reported. And all of the information that, I received was that this was something that she wanted to do, that this wasn't something that she was told to do by the government. And I have to say in the conversation that both the president and myself and Peter Robinson had with her at the Lyrica Theatre, it's quite obvious that we were speaking to someone who is a very staunch supporter of the peace process.
So are you sorry now that you didn't attend that dinner in her honour in Dublin Castle in 2011?
No, I think at that time the party decided that the time wasn't right. But important things have happened since then, including, of course, the contribution made by Queen Elizabeth herself during the course of that visit.
Martin McGuinness talking to Richard Crowley on Last Sunday's This Week. On the day of the banquet, Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams also spoke to Anya Lawler on the News at One.
What do you say to Republicans there for Gerry Adams, who will be watching Martin McGuinness sit down to take the Queen's supper, having journeyed, I mean, you've journeyed all the way, you know, from the H blocks to Windsor Castle, but there's still no United Ireland, nor there isn't a United Ireland imminent. So what would you say to those Republicans who are saying it would still be too soon to do this?
Well, first of all, we now have a peaceful and democratic way of bringing about a United Ireland. And Sinn Féin have accepted entirely that the onus is on us, along with others, to persuade those folks in the North particularly who are unionists that they have a place in that United Ireland. And the United Ireland, the New Ireland, has to be one in which those who see themselves as British can feel at home, can have ownership. And this Martin being there shows vision and tolerance. It's a sign of a confident Sinn Féin leadership. You know, and just let me just elaborate on this a wee bit, if I may, Anya. Martin McGuinness's best man, Colm Keenan, who actually introduced him to his wife, Bernie, was shot to death by the British Army. My brother-in-law, Patrick Mulvenna, an IRA volunteer, was shot to death by the British Army, and my sister Frances was pregnant with his child. My brother Paddy was seriously wounded by the British Army. My mother and sisters were harassed on an ongoing... My home was wrecked. I was beaten unconscious on a number of occasions. Now, if Martin can come where he has come from, and if, in fairness to her, Queen Elizabeth, who has also suffered bereavement in her family, can welcome him, then isn't that good for the relationships on this island and between the people of this island and Britain?
Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams talking to Anya Lawler on Tuesday's News at One. On Thursday's Today Show, meanwhile, Colin Parry, whose son Tim was killed in the Warrington bombing, spoke to Sean O'Rourke about his thoughts on the visit. He also gave his reaction to comments made by Norman Tebbit about his wish that IRA dissidents might shoot Martin McGuinness.
Well, at best, I'd like to think he was joking. But I suspect he wasn't. I think it's outrageous as a comment from a former senior politician on so many levels. It's just it's outrageous or idiotic. I think it just reminds people of the dark days when so many people had extreme views that thankfully have receded to a large extent now.
Well, he's, I suppose, not just a senior politician. He's somebody who suffered grievously himself. He was seriously injured in the Brighton bomb, and indeed his wife was effectively paralysed as a result of it.
Well, that's true. I mean, nobody could ever diminish the pain he and his wife and his family suffered, but the suggestion that somebody should murder another human being by shooting them in the back is, as I say, an outrageous comment, and I think it's all the sadder that it's coming from a man like Norman Tebbit, who you would have imagined all these years on might have found some space in his heart to move on a bit.
Colin Parry talking to Sean O'Rourke on the Today Show on Thursday. Later on Thursday night, meanwhile, Irish artists and musicians and an audience of 5,500 lucky people descended on the Royal Albert Hall for a kind of a rap party called Kalura. I'll be bringing you some of the music from that show later on, but this piece is an excerpt from Drive Time columnist Olivia O'Leary.
There are things we could learn from you, the British, just as there are things that you could learn from us. That relationship wasn't possible when the weight of history was at its heaviest between us. Injustice and violence in Northern Ireland and two world wars cast a long shadow. Those thousands of Irishmen who fought in the First War returned home to find their country involved in a struggle for independence, a struggle in which they were on the wrong side. My own grandfather was arrested as an IRA officer after the 1916 rising. He was held in Reading Jail, where his brother, who was in the medical corps of the British Army, came to see him in uniform. The warders couldn't understand why this British officer was coming to see this rebel. There's hardly a family in Ireland that doesn't have a story like that. Many Irish people served in the Second World War as well. My two aunts joined the Queen Alexandra's Imperial Military Nursing Service. Peggy went in after D-Day to nurse in field hospitals in Normandy. Kitty was torpedoed on her way to serve in India, but Kitty survived. She escaped Catholic Ireland. She developed a posh accent. She married an Anglican, became an Anglican, and was made an usher in Canterbury Cathedral. Every Christmas, instead of the usual Holy Mary nativity scene, she'd send us a Christmas card of the cathedral. It used to drop through our letterbox onto the tiled hall floor like a gauntlet. It drove her staunch Irish Catholic brothers and sisters wild. But we loved Kitty for living the life that she wanted to live. And when she died, her Irish family arrived over with fiddles and flutes to give her a proper Irish farewell. She was buried in the War Memorial Garden at Canterbury. As her coffin was carried out of the crypt, the chief boy soprano from the choir sang, "She moved through the fair." Her children said, "We had to have a little bit of Ireland there."
Olivia O'Leary is heard on the stage of the Royal Albert Hall and live on the John Creedon Show slot on Radio 1 on Thursday. Going back to the commentary surrounding the first day of the visit on Tuesday, there are plenty of good yarns being told by guests on the Today Show. Ever wondered what the Queen carries around in her handbag? Well, PR advisor to Mary McAleese, Eileen Gleeson, found out when she had lunch with the Queen as part of Mary McAleese's delegation back in 1999.
There were about 10 or 11 people around the table. And what I thought, you know, I was obviously going to Buckingham Palace for the first time and being led through the protocol said you will walk through the Carnarvon room and the 1844 room and your lunch will be in the 18th century room and that you'll walk then through the Marble Hall and the Bow Room. And you knew you were living through history and that you would try and remember all of the details of the visit. The only thing I can't remember is what was on the menu because I was watching people so much and watching where we were and the surroundings that we were in. And of course, all my friends, all they wanted to know was come back and tell us what does the Queen carry in her handbag that she has with her all the time and little details like that. But we had a reception first in a room. There was about 10 people there and she talked. She reminded me of my mother. In fact, she talked about the weather. She talked about the traffic. And I think there was a delegation of a state visit coming the following week. I think if I recall correctly, it was from China. And she was saying, oh, gosh, there'll be so many people and they'll create such a lot of traffic and a lot of disruption around London.
Did you find out what was in the handbag?
Yes, I did. I did, because she did something which I thought was unusual. At the end of lunch, she took the handbag and placed it on the table and took out her lipstick and replenished her lipstick, which I thought was unusual. And I was delighted. I knew some people in Ireland that used to do that and thought that maybe it wasn't the most protocol thing to do. But I thought afterwards, if the Queen can do it, then anybody can do it. So she had her tissue and she had her little lipstick.
Eileen Gleeson, as heard on the Today Show on Tuesday. Irish journalist John McEntee was another panellist on that same show who told us another fascinating fact about the Queen when Sean was waxing lyrical about the beauty of Windsor.
But it has one disadvantage, but maybe which the Queen has turned to her advantage. Yeah. It's on a flight path into Heathrow.
Indeed, aeroplanes fly over all the time. And if you get a chance to ask the President when you see him, when he returns, ask him if he slept with all the aeroplanes. But so Peter O'Sullivan, another great Irishman. The legendary voice of race. Now 96 and still going strong. But he was telling me recently he'd visited the Royal Stud, which is near here. He's a great horseman and she loves horses. And he said he was having lunch with the Queen, not in the St. George's Hall where the state banquet will be, but in a private dining room, in her own dining room, and with the Duke of Edinburgh. And the aeroplanes were flying overhead. And without sort of batting an eyelid, she said, "Airbus." And So Peter looked at her, and then the next aeroplane in 30 seconds or 60 seconds, she said 747. And then 727. And Peter told me that she actually knew the make of the aeroplane by the sound of the engine, because they're so frequently flying overhead. And it must be a nuisance, because it's nothing worse than having it.
Clearly well known to her all at this stage. And she probably didn't have to look up quite clearly.
And there is that apocryphal story when Ronald Reagan was staying here, and he said, ma'am, tell me, why did you build the castle so close to Heathrow?
John McEntee is heard on Tuesday's Today Show, as was Mary Kenny, who herself had a nice story to tell, not about the Queen, but about our president, Michael D. Higgins.
As it happens, yes, Sean, I did make his match. I introduced him to Sabina it was one of those 1960s parties, and you know what they say about the 1960s, if you can remember it, you weren't there. And it was one of these rather wild parties that I gave in my flat in Dublin. And Michael O'Leary, that's not the Ryanair Michael O'Leary, but the Taunish at the time, brought along this radical young left-wing lecturer to the party. And my sister, who was then studying drama with Deirdre O'Connell, brought along her friend Sabina Coyle, who was also studying drama with Deirdre O'Connell, who was a very famous drama teacher in Dublin. She was married to Luke Kelly of the Dubliners, and they clicked, and that was it. I mean, I just happened to be the agency that was
The rest, as they say, is history between Sabina Coyne and Lee Higgins.
Writer and matchmaker Mary Kenny has heard on Tuesday's Today Show. The death of Peaches Geldof, the 25-year-old daughter of Bob Geldof, on Monday, was one which couldn't fail to cast a shadow over the celebrations surrounding the Irish in Britain this week. On Tuesday's Today Show, broadcaster Dave Fanning reflected on the tragic death of Peaches Geldof.
There's one very sort of poignant thing that she herself has said in some of her blog stuff, where she went on about the fact that the divorce really hit her very hard. And one week she'd be with Paula, which was a real mess living with her, and the next week she'd be with Bob, who was like virtually Dickensian, like eat your dinner, take your greens, go to bed, do your homework, get dressed, do your teeth, all that kind of thing. And she couldn't take the difference in each different kind of week and that. And Bob was just doing the best he could without having as many people need. I'm not saying everybody has or everybody can get it, but everybody needs two people. It's just so great. And he was just as lost. That divorce was a terrible mess, played out in the tabloids, and everybody suffered.
And his statement yesterday, it said so much in a very few words, really heartbreaking stuff, conveying the shock of the family at Peach's death.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like, you know, there are those who say, wow, you know, like, how much more can this guy take? I mean, his sister died a few years ago, his father died a few years ago. When Paula died, there was reconciliation that could have happened more than had happened, say, 4 or 5 years after the divorce. But as I say, the divorce itself, like, it was just so messy that he didn't really want to talk about it too much.
He really is going to have to call Dave on all his reserves of strength at this time.
Well, you've got to remember also back to around 1977, 78, when the Rats were making a big deal. And, like, the Rats were supposedly a punk band, whatever that means. They weren't really. They were just a rock band. But they got two number one singles in Britain at the time that really meant something. And so, like, they were huge. And the man was a mouth. And his daughter, Peaches, was exactly the same in so many ways. He was the wildest and the funniest and the cleverest and the most bonkers as well. And do you remember his appearances on The Late Late Show with Gay Byrne, shocking everybody? Because he went to the same school as me. He was in my brother's class. And I remember him well in school, the first guy I ever saw on one of those little bikes, and kind of a mad guy, crazy in so many ways. And he was a few years ahead of me in school, and he used to just rail against the whole of religion of Ireland, this terrible country, banana republic and all that kind of thing. So he had loads to say in a very articulate way about a lot of things. And any time I've seen Peaches on TV, particularly that recent time which has gone on about parenting, of how much she loves 24-hour day parenting, if you like, with the two kids, as opposed to the expert who was sitting beside her, and she annihilated the expert. It was hilarious. That's just 6 weeks ago. Like father, like daughter.
Dave Fanning has heard on the Today Show on Tuesday. Prompted by the shocking news of a savage attack on boxer John Joe Nevin, in which he had both of his legs broken last weekend, Daily Mail columnist Brenda Power wrote a piece criticising the travelling community for this kind of attack and its representative bodies for failing to issue statements condemning violence within their community. The Equality Authority, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties and Pavey Point all issued statements criticising Brenda Power's article. And on Wednesday's Liveline, she and Martin Collins of Pavey Point took part in a heated debate on the subject.
Brenda, we don't issue statements on every single
item or issue impacting on travellers. But I am making it very clear to you and your listeners that what happened to John Joe, I mean, obviously there's an investigation into it and we must let the that investigation take its course. But it was appalling and, you know, as I said, we do wish him a speedy recovery because he's a very proud traveller man and he takes great pride in representing his community and his country.
But is that not Brenda's point, Martin? You should have issued a statement about John Joe because of his
I don't agree, Joe. We don't issue a statement on every single item or issue relating to travellers. That's
why, because it's so common. These incidents of feuds and savagery and barbarism are so common, you'd have no time for anything else.
Brenda, I mean, there's no need for that emotive language. Absolutely no need. That has no place. That has no place. What I'm saying is, we're for an intelligent, open, frank debate, but there has to be respect and there has to be boundaries. Your article is not about contributing to an intelligent...
Because as soon as anybody raises a peep against you, you're running to the Equality Authority.
I'm all for free speech. I'm all for free speech, Brenda. But
the Equality Authority aren't,
speech.
And they will shut me down and stop me expressing myself, expressing a view that I'd be very surprised if I was the only person in the country to hold this view, by the way, and the Equality Authority, in their wisdom,
I'm sure you're not the only person in the country that holds that view, but just because there's other people who hold that view doesn't necessarily make it right. Look, the only point I'm making here, Brenda, is everybody has an opinion, everybody should contribute to a debate on travel issues and relations between travellers and settlers. We're all for that. Brenda, please.
What you want to hear, you're all for it.
If anybody takes issue with you, you're running to the Equality Authority.
Journalist Brenda Power and Martin Collins of Pavey Point, as heard on Wednesday's Liveline. Wednesday's late debate also dealt with the issue of travellers and ethnic groups living in Ireland. Gabby Muntian, who is originally from Romania but living in Ireland for 14 years, spoke about her financial struggle in her early years living in Ireland and the negative perception surrounding the Roma community.
Before I was working in Ireland, and because I was not habitually resident, I could not apply to any benefits. So I had to sell flowers, and I was begging as well and selling flowers, selling big issues. And people were calling me names. People were speaking bad about me. I did not understand at the time the meaning of the words because I was not speaking very good English. But sometimes I didn't bother what they are speaking about me and why they are saying that to me. But it was time when I did not have money to send my child with a proper lunch to school. Mm-hmm. It was time when I did not have the uniform. My son had only one uniform. He never has second trousers. And I remember one day he was playing in the school and his trouser got wrecked. I had to buy a new one, and he had to wait for 2 days until he has to go to school because I did not have the money. My child was asking me all the time for money, you know, like pockets money, like all the teenage. Mm-hmm. So I never had the money to give him. They were giving me the money after 2 years, the child benefit. So it was hard. Sometimes we can see... in the media, guards speaking about Roma people without knowing us. Sometimes they just say that begging is in our culture, and it's totally not. We are not cultural beggars. We are forced to beg, yes.
Gabby Muntian talking to Audrey Carvel on Wednesday's late debate. On Friday's Morning Ireland, meanwhile, reporter Aisling Kenny visited Maria Gunday and her two daughters, who have been living in a direct provision centre in the west of Ireland since they came over from Zimbabwe 4 years ago. The first voice you'll hear is that of Jacqueline Gunday, who is studying for her Leaving Cert in the cramped mobile home where she lives when Aisling visited the family. Jacqueline spoke about her concerns about getting a third level education.
If you're living in direct provision and you haven't got your papers yet, you're not able to go on to third level education, which is really worrying because most of my friends, they'll be off going to college. And I, unfortunately, if we don't have our residency by then, I'll have to be here still in direct provision. I believe God is there and, you know, you have to give it all to God and hopefully he'll help me to get to third level education.
But our teacher says that...
Maria's other daughter, Jahira, who's in third class, says living in direct provision and going to school can be difficult.
In our school, like, we get book rental and it's kind of still expensive, but my mom can't really afford the money, so I kind of feel sad because, like, everybody gets to get the book.
Jahira has also experienced bullying in school at times.
People weren't, like, bullies weren't saying nice things about me. Like, oh, you don't belong here. You have short hair and everything. They were saying, oh, like, you live in a caravan, at least we live in a house.
What's playing next? What game is that?
We're making bracelets.
14-year-old Malawi lives in the mobile home beside Maria's family in the direct provision site.
Yes, it is quite difficult because, you know, you don't have the same, like, stuff as your friends, and sometimes we go on trips and you can't go because you just simply don't have the money to go. Your friends will ask you why you're not able to go, and it's kind of embarrassing telling your friends that I don't have money. So, like, sometimes I just have to tell my friends lies.
Malawi wants nothing more than to get a good education, but she finds it difficult to study in the conditions that she lives in.
Yeah, it is hard because I have an older brother who's also trying to afford his education but simply can't. And, like, Moban's quite small, so, like, if my mom's in the next room, I can hear everything and I lose my concentration, especially in homework and studying, and it becomes quite hard for me. I'd like to go to Oxford University and study to become a doctor and become a good doctor and be able to buy my mum her own house and everything like that. Yeah.
From Aisling Kenny's report on Friday's Morning Ireland. Another reporter who spoke to school children on air this week was Brenda Donoghue, and you couldn't help but be struck by the contrast between the two reports. Mary Hines, who's been a teacher at St Raphael's National School in Ballyfermot for the past 29 years, wrote into The Mooney Show telling them that she believes that hers is the happiest school in Ireland. Could this be true? Brenda Donoghue ventured forth with microphone in hand to investigate that claim.
What's your name?
Ryan.
And what age are you, Ryan?
4.
Do you like school?
Yeah.
And why?
Because I love my teacher so much.
Oh. And what's your teacher's name?
Mrs. Corton.
Is she ever cross?
No.
What does she do with you?
She puts on movies.
Yeah. Who's your best friend?
Evan.
Evan. And what's your name?
Evan.
Evan, oh my goodness. And your best friends?
Ryan.
Ryan. And tell me, what do you like about school?
The kitchen. I love cooking. I made nests for Easter in the kitchens, and we're allowed to eat them when we get home.
That sounds really good fun. And do you have fun in school?
Yes.
What's your name?
Ruby. I love my teacher so much.
Oh. And what's her name?
Miss Curtin.
She sounds like a cool... Oh, look, she's running and hiding. She's so proud of you. Surely she gets cross sometimes.
No.
No?
Probably sometimes.
Yeah. Do you all know your numbers and your letters?
Yeah, and I can count in Irish.
Go on, do it for me.
My name's Alex.
Alex, and what age are you?
6.
What do you like about the school?
I like about school because our helper, Margaret, she gives us biscuits and she puts chocolate spreads on them and they're really yummy.
I'd like her too.
When you win, so a teacher has this book and it's called Student of the Week and Gergar and Shuckton. If you get Student of the Week, you get this badge and it says Student of the Week on it. And if you get Gergar and Shuckton, it's a cert and you can get a pencil or something.
I hope you get one day.
I did.
What? Did you? Were you Student of the Week?
No.
Not Gaelgor of the week.
Gaelgor and a Shachtana.
Oh, Gaelgor and a Shachtana. Well done.
I got 4 of them.
You got 4 of them? You must be pretty brainy, are you?
Yeah.
From Brenda Donoghue's report on Wednesday's Mooney. Veteran broadcaster Larry Gogan was a guest on last week's Sunday with Miriam. He spoke about his career in broadcasting, and at this point in the interview, he tells Miriam about his late wife, Florrie.
We were married for 39 years. She was 21 when we
Tell
were married.
Tell me how you met her.
Well, it's strangely, my father was a newsagent. We had a newsagent shop in Fairview. And Florrie's father was also a newsagent, Duffy's, Lucky Duffy's in Parnell Street. And I think, about 16 or so, and I wanted to find out something to do with newsagent. And went into his shop. She was there. She was about 15. And when she left school then, she came to work for us in our shop in Fairview, and then she ran the shop. And we started going out together when we were about 18 or so. So I had a very happy life, and had five children.
How many grandchildren?
12.
Wow.
Down from 17 down to one.
And you'd a very happy marriage. One of your philosophies, you didn't really ever fight. You didn't believe in arguing.
People never believed that, but we didn't actually. You know, I just let whatever she said, I did. And people never believed that. People say, oh, that couldn't be true, you know. But it is.
When did she get ill?
She got ill. She got breast cancer, and she had. She was, I think, about 57, and she had a mastectomy. She seemed to be grand. And 3 years later, we were actually ready to go away. We were going away to Portugal for holidays, and she went to get a checkup. And the man said, Dr. Crown, you know, Professor Crown, said, you're not going anywhere, you know, that it had returned. And he said, if you didn't get whatever he used, then you'd be dead in 6 months, something like that. She was actually dead in 6 months, even though they tried all the different things and none of them worked.
How did you cope during that time?
It's very hard. It's hard to kind of hard to believe it, first of all, like that this could happen to you, because you know, the children were reared, you know, and you think that now is the time where you're going to have a great time yourselves. But as they say, the well-laid plans of mice and men wasn't to be.
Larry Gogan talking to Miriam O'Callaghan last Sunday. Another well-known name who spoke on air this week about the death of her loved ones was Honor Heffernan. On Monday's Today Show, she told Sean O'Rourke about how her mother and sister both died from carbon monoxide poisoning.
We had a little over-the-sink geyser in our kitchen, which was serviced regularly. Basically, it malfunctioned and my mother and sister died as a result of carbon monoxide poisoning.
And you tell me about your mother and your sister, because your mother was still a relatively young woman, wasn't she?
She was. She was 76. And she was a wonderful woman. In fact, my father had died 2 years before that. And my sister was Down syndrome, Fiona. But my mother was one of these mothers that all my friends loved her and all our friends loved her and still talk about her. She was a very young at heart, vibrant woman who herself had had a triple bypass the week before my father died in the same hospital. So she was a great, strong, gentle, lovely woman. And my sister Fiona was the light of our lives, you know, and our lives revolved around the three of them when my dad was alive, and when he died, we became even more involved with them. But they were just wonderful people, you know, gentle, lovely, kind. I think most people would speak about their parents like that.
It must have been, clearly was, stating the obvious, I suppose, a dreadful tragedy, not just for your family, but it sounds like for a neighbourhood as well.
Oh, the whole neighbourhood, all the friends. And you see, my parents were born in that area as well.
Whereabouts?
Well, certainly my mother moved to Benburb Street. Her father was a barber, Martin Walsh. He was the barber for Collins Barracks, and then he bought his own shop in Benburb Street. So they were there. My mother was there from the time she was about 8. And my dad lived in Stony Batter as well. So all their neighbours were also friends, and a lot of the neighbours lived there all their lives as well and married
and
there.
When she and your sister died, Honor, what about the aftermath? How clear was it, presumably from the postmortems initially, that carbon monoxide had been the cause? But what about this presumably a systems failure that had arisen? What were you able to establish about that?
It seems that the geyser itself was faulty. You know,
From the start?
Well, perhaps not from the start, even though it had been serviced about four months before that. It can just fail. Something can happen. Something can block the flue. Something tiny can cause the machine to malfunction, basically, if we'd had an alarm or if we'd had a new geyser that was fitted with this oxygen depletory valve. There would have been no problem.
Honor Heffernan talking to Sean O'Rourke on Monday. Wednesday's Arena featured a charming report from Evelyn O'Rourke, in which she interviewed the O'Donoghue sisters, who she came across this week when she was attending the annual Fesh Ciol competition in Dublin.
Well, gentlemen, for the last 12 years, I'd say my sister has been coming for how many?
25 at least.
25 years we call. For every day for the 2 weeks, mostly for singing and choirs. And we get to know all the young people that are growing up, all the young musicians of the future. You know.
And 25 years you've been coming.
Yes.
So it's a highlight in your calendar every year.
Oh, yes, definitely. You know, it's very interesting. We have our programme, see who's going to win. I pick one and maybe she'd pick another, you know. We're not in music ourselves at all, you know.
So you didn't play as a youngster?
Not at all. We didn't sing or play or anything.
We can't even read music. But
we just like music. You know?
And how did you sort of stumble upon the idea of coming?
Our eldest sister's children were involved, you know, piano. So I started coming with her and then she died. And then this sister arrived home from Peru, where she was stationed for a long time. And we started coming then.
Well, I always say, you know, these recitals, somebody would sing four songs. Well, there'd be two that you've never heard before, like, you know. And you get to know a whole lot of new ones. And I love songs.
Would you recommend it to people?
Oh, yeah. We're always very annoyed that more people don't come. But there must be millions of retired people who have nothing else to do that like music and that did music, you know.
They always say, you know, you mean you sit and you listen to the same song being sung for 40 times, but they all sing it in a different way. Mm-hmm. And they're funny sometimes and sometimes they're serious and sometimes they have to be consoled and, you know, it's just lovely.
Ladies, I will leave you to it. You put your flask there.
Would you like a bun?
I'd love a bun.
Is there a bit messy to get out quickly? You know,
Evelyn O'Rourke sharing a bun with the O'Donoghue sisters at the Fechgiol in Dublin, as heard on Wednesday's Arena. Collectaholics were featured on this week's John Murray Show. One of those interviewed was John Weldon, who told John Murray on Tuesday about a substantial collection of rubber ducks.
When did this begin, this fascination for rubber ducks, John?
Yeah, my nanny used to call me Ducky when I was a child. And when she died in 2000, I started to collect rubber ducks in her honour. It's got a bit out of hand, to be honest, though, John.
I see. How many ducks have you now?
I have 122 rubber ducks.
Where exactly? What room in the house are they in?
Well, Imelda, she only lets me put them in the downstairs toilet, so that's where they're confined.
Is there any room left in the downstairs toilet?
There's very, very little room left in there, so I'm going to have to go into negotiations to expand them out into the kitchen or the dining room.
Yeah, and I believe, is it your mother doesn't like using that particular room?
Yeah, my mother won't do her business in there. She doesn't like all the ducks looking at her, so she has to toddle upstairs to do her business.
Oh, lovely. And tell me, have you favourite rubber ducks of them all?
I have. I suppose Duck Vader is my favourite duck, and I suppose my beloved Arsenal duck.
Ah, lovely. So you're an Arsenal fan?
I mean, I did think about melting my Everton duck at the weekend, though, but he survived.
Okay, despite them beating Arsenal. And how do you go about collecting them? Is there a place that is a rubber duck store?
There's a rubber duck world online where you can get any kind of rubber duck you want, but I generally try to pick them up anywhere that I go. So if I'm anywhere in Europe, I try to pick up a rubber duck and scouring through souvenir shops looking for my ducky.
I see. And your wife, Imelda, is she happy enough with your rubber duck fascination?
No, she's appalled.
Grown man and rubber duck collector John Weldon, as heard on Tuesday's John Murray Show. Also on Tuesday, Sebastian Barry was on Arena, where he read beautifully from his new novel, The Temporary Gentleman.
1926. Our marriage. On the one side of the church, the rather elegant and choice individuals who had travelled to see May wed. Her aunt, Maria Sheridan from Cavan, the one with the connection to Collins, encased in a brocaded day dress, giving her a slightly ironclad look, but very smart. May's other aunts from Roscommon, Cavan and Leitrim, glinting in the holy gloom of the chapel, with small dots of gold and ruby light playing on old rings and necklaces and bracelets. And chief before all, her resplendent brother, Jack, the doctor from Roscommon, lofty, silk-hatted, confident and silent. He was a man May adored, and he was said to adore her, even if he was a rare visitor being devoted to fishing the rivers of Roscommon and shooting at the wildlife there. He was 6'6" in his stockings, I knew, and in every way he was as impressive to me as her father had been, and I prayed he would approve of me. All of these souls sitting on their side, with the easy, rather solemn, occupying air that in other circumstances would have put me in suspicion that they were actually Protestants. On the other side, my side, my very dapper brother Tom, in his best suit, tailored by my father, of course, and no tailor in Dublin could have made a better one, even if it was a few years out of date, strictly speaking. But if he looked provincial, nevertheless, it was provincial with a touch of pleasing swagger about it. Then there was my father, old Tom, who had decided to retrieve a straw boater from some dark corner of his bedroom. And he had fashioned for himself a set of tails and black trousers, to some degree let down by an old grey coat, an item he never attempted as a tailor, and so was shop bought. He sat very still on the pew, with his eyes closed, so that he looked like one of those old photographs of executed train robbers in America, put out somewhere as a warning to the frontier populace. Beside him sat my mother, and something in the day had undone her intention somewhat, because it is probably true to say that her attire was not quite right. She wore her old cloth hat and her plain black severe little dress that, unlike Maria Sheridan's, which was also severe, had not cost too much in the first place, because my mother didn't care about such things. May herself, then, coming in on the arm of Nicholas Sheridan, Maria's husband, in her wedding dress, a long brush mark of silk.
Sebastian Barry reading from his new novel, The Temporary Gentleman, on Tuesday's Arena. That's about my lot for this week. I was spoiled for choice picking a song from Thursday night's Kalura to play us out this morning. I particularly loved the Glenn Hansard-led rendition of The Owl Triangle, but I don't think George Lee, who's up next on the business, would be too impressed if I replayed it this morning, since it's nearly 9 minutes long. Here instead is the equally wonderful but slightly shorter Falling Slowly, sung by Glenn Hansard and Lisa Hannigan. I'm Fiona Kelly. So until next week, goodbye.
hit the coast lane. Now you're gone.
Thank you.